KZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to pay nearly $2 billion in foreign aid, but stopped short of blocking a review of foreign aid payments. The downturn on Wall Street just temporary, say some Republican lawmakers to ABC News. Analysts blame the uncertainty over an apparently starting tariff war between the U.S. and Mexico and Canada. Moody's chief economist Mark Zandi.
I think other countries aren't going to stand still. They're going to respond. So if we put tariffs on their goods, they're going to put tariffs on our goods. The Chinese have done that.
Dead, all three people aboard the AirCare medical helicopter that crashed near Canton, Mississippi today, says the University of Mississippi Medical Center. It says no patients were aboard, but two hospital crew members and a pilot were. One crew member is missing from a Portuguese-flagged cargo ship that crashed into a U.S. fuel tanker off eastern England. Fog was reported. The ships are still burning and leaking fuel. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
NFL free agency frenzy. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Packers making moves in free agency. They've decided not to re-sign center Josh Myers. Instead, they bring in 49ers left guard Aaron Banks. The 27-year-old 6'6" Banks agreeing to a 4-year contract with Green Bay worth $77 million. It's likely Elgton Jenkins will move from left guard to center. On defense, the Packers adding another player from the Raiders. It's defensive back Nate Hobbs. A 4-year deal worth $46 million, $16 million guaranteed. The Packers losing 27-year-old defensive lineman TJ Slayton today. He'll join the Bengals on a 2-year deal worth over $15 million. NBA, the Bucks headed to Indianapolis to play the Pacers tomorrow night after losing to the Cavaliers at home 112-100.
Offensively, we're not good enough to win the game. I thought just standard defense, we did enough to win the game. We didn't do anything else enough.
That's Bucks head coach Doc Rivers with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Welcome in author Laura Ann Bird to talk to us more about what we can find in a book, or in the case of this week, a book club.
It's called a silent book club. You go to either a coffee shop or distillery or bar with a bunch of other people. You're all reading different books. You walk away from these with like great recommendations. It's sort of like a show and tell of what everyone's reading.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 until 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. The big news over the weekend was Trump and the administration pulled collective bargaining rights away from about 50,000 TSA agents. And again, something was hard fought for. Workers fought hard to get collective bargaining rights in that industry. And now just like that, gone. Contracts don't matter. Legislation doesn't matter. Past practice doesn't matter. Gone. All gone. And look, told you that was going to happen. Told you he was going to go after the federal employees. What I thought was interesting, saw a Reuters article, and a woman from West Virginia they interviewed, and her and about 125 other people who work at the Treasury Department's Bureau of Fiscal Services in Parkersburg, West Virginia, lost their jobs. And she was like, you know, I supported him. I voted for him 3 times. I didn't know he was coming after me. I didn't know it would be my job that would get cut. I didn't think it was going to be people who look like me. It was supposed to be others. It was supposed to be them. Those people. Not us. We were supposed to be the ones laughing. And now here we are. And what's interesting is she said, well, you know, I don't support him now. And you go, well, of course not. Because it happened to you. Even though we told you, and what's interesting is as they interviewed her, she's like, I guess that was kind of dumb. I wanted the cuts. I just didn't want it to be me. And was fully supportive when it was someone else. Now, you know, Trump convinced a whole bunch of people that it wasn't going to happen. You know, great con man, great used car salesman. Now, the weird thing is, West Virginia overwhelmingly voted for Trump and simultaneously has the highest percentage of government jobs per capita, which means the people who most supported him are going to be the ones affected most by it. And I'm okay with that on a certain level. I'm okay with it because this is what you asked for. You're getting what you asked for. You just didn't think it was you. You were okay when it happened to somebody else. And the thing is it got me thinking over the weekend because I look at Trump and I see him as a liar, a thief, and a cheat, a philanderer and all of that stuff. Because you look at his record. And I thought about my grandfather, who's been gone for quite a few years now. He warned me that you never trust a liar. You never trust a thief. You never trust a cheater. And it got me thinking, you know, I wonder what he would say about someone who was all three. I know he wouldn't have elected him president, but you kind of got to wonder, how is it we got to this place? And we got to this place because we didn't care about your truth or any of that stuff. We cared, or some, that he was going to go after the right people, the people that we didn't like. He was going to make it okay to be racist and homophobic and misogynistic while believing that we were going to get better. We were going to be able to get from them. We're going to get those jobs back. We were going to get that standard of living back. And understand, they bought it. For instance, he said he was going to bring back, usher in the golden age of the economy. It was going to be great again. We were going to make the economy great. In fact, inflation was going to be gone. Day one. Egg prices, what was it, 99 cents a dozen? Buck a gallon gas. It was going to be great. It was going to be awesome. Now, well, kind of walking that back down. Because a lot of the craziness that he's doing, a lot of the disruptive things that they're doing is causing a lot of economic unease. Let's put it that way. To where now you got people like Maria Bartiromo on Fox News asking, are you expecting a recession this year? She said there are rising worries about the slowdown. Are you expecting a recession? And Trump's response is, well, I hate to predict things like that. There is a period of transition. So look, he's not going to rule out that a recession's possible in 2025 because it's his doing. As consumer confidence has the biggest monthly decline since August of 2021, you got to wonder what caused that. Now remember, Mr. Art of the Deal, Mr. Day One, we're going to kick inflation's behind. Eggs are going to be plentiful. An egg on every plate. And yet now eggs are more expensive than they've ever been in my lifetime. Or I got to think in history of eggs. But again, that's the last guys. Well, Biden did that. Biden. Not the complete and total chaos that you've caused. Now, you remember, during the Biden years, the right kept screaming that every week was going to be a recession. Every week, recession was coming. As we were investing in infrastructure, as we were investing in new technologies and jobs, and as we were attempting to move the economy in the right direction. What you now have is all of this chaotic activity of stripping funding out of the economy. Now, look, I'm no great economist. But the federal government is a large driver of consumption in this country. It's a large driver of employment in this country. It puts money into pockets. That money then gets spent into on the main street and also on the Wall Street. What happens when you start yanking that money out? I think of the people in Parkersburg, West Virginia, heavily Republican area, who are now losing their job. And now, you know, thanks to the Reuters report, we see marching in the streets, angry about what Trump is doing because it's hit their home. It's not a they don't care about recession. It's depression at home. because they're not going to get the kind of job that they had with the kind of benefits that they had. They were on easy street. They were the kind of people that the anti-government folks are after. And yet somehow they thought they were special. And somehow that it wasn't going to be them. For whatever reason. They work hard or they're just the right. Check the box. So here's my point. It's easy to gloat. And say good for them. Good on them. I'm not there. This is an opportunity to reach those people. This is an opportunity to go, look, we told you this was going to happen. Project 2025 was pretty clear. They were pretty upfront about it. Your suffering is real. How can we help? And how do we get you to get on board and organize with us to move forward? Because understand, there's going to be more of this. More communities are going to get hit really hard by what Trump is doing. And the suffering is going to be real. So how do we organize around the solution moving forward? See, for me, that's the question. These people, they're gonna have a tough time. Because they're, as I said, West Virginia has the highest per capita number of federal jobs, number of government jobs. When those go away, what fills the void? Does the private sector jump in and go, we're going to fill it? No. There's just pain and suffering. And oh, when they go to collect unemployment, you know, the one that's been diminished and cut. Well, another opportunity to organize. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember back during the first Trump term, oddly enough, less chaotic than this one. You may remember that one of the big talking points of in this campaign of why Trump was going to be the guy was because of how well he did at renegotiating NAFTA, or what we now call the USMCA. And as I'm reading it, not doing great. In fact, trade deficits actually going up, which is why I think Trump, again, is threatening both partners in this. And here to share some thoughts on what needs to be done, how we might get there. I've asked my good friend Arthur Stamoulos to come talk with Arthur. Arthur is the executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. They've got a letter that they've now sent out to Trade Representative Jamison Greer. I want to get his thoughts. Arthur, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
So I thought this was a done deal. I thought the USMCA was tremendous. It was amazing. It was the deal.
Yeah. So folks may remember when Trump was first running for the White House, he promised voters that he was going to get rid of NAFTA on his first day in office, and that's not exactly how it worked out. Instead, he spent over a year renegotiating NAFTA into what he rebranded the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. And, you know, there were some improvements relative to NAFTA. There were some new corporate giveaways relative to NAFTA. But 90-95% of the pact is exactly the same. And actually, the effects of the agreement are almost exactly the same. We're now 5 years into our fifth year of the USMCA, And as you said, the trade deficit with Canada and Mexico has skyrocketed relative to NAFTA. We continue to see good paying jobs sent to Mexico to take advantage of weak labor rights, lax pollution controls, abysmally low wages. And we're seeing import surges in everything from automobiles to aerospace to steel to agriculture. So there's now this mandatory review of the USMCA that's beginning this year. And we're saying, let's use that opportunity to make this into a deal that finally works for working families, for family farmers, for communities. Or if you can't do that, you know, with your master negotiating team, then do what you promised to do 8 or 9 years ago and just get us out of this deal altogether. Because, you know, no deal is better than a bad deal. Ultimately, we'd rather have a good deal.
Right.
But if we can't get there, at least get us out of this.
Now, what do you say to those who would say, well, that's what he's trying to do with all this tariff talk, that all these tariffs are to address the failure of his grand deal and that they're taking this seriously? Do you buy any of that?
Look, I mean, we support, our coalition supports using tariffs as a way to support good paying jobs in the United States and to promote a more fair and resilient economy globally. For the most part, that's not what Trump is doing or accomplishing with his tariffs chaos right now. You know, first off, he's flat out said that he wants to use tariffs to replace income taxes. In other words, to cut taxes for himself and his billionaire buddies. You know, even if tariff revenue were somehow equivalent to income tax revenue, which it's not and is nowhere close to being. But even if it were, the only way tariffs replace existing tax revenue is if the tariffs never lead to new job creation and don't end up displacing imports with increased U.S. production. So, you know, he and his administration are out there openly describing what this is really about: tax cuts for the rich, not better paying jobs for U.S. workers. And then beyond his words, I mean, I can go into the ways where, you know, his tariff plans are not being optimized to create jobs, to create new industry, you know, to support working families in this country, because a large number of Americans do support tariffs, even if they increase costs, which is massively overblown in the corporate media. But even if they increase costs, if it ends up protecting U.S. jobs and helping U.S. manufacturing.
And that being the key to it, Arthur, right?
In our world, it's not happening.
Yeah, that being the key to it. If it does lead to what we were promised, and the sad reality is a lot of what this guy promises never leads to what, we never get what he promises. We get, well, the short end of the stick. And I agree with you. I'm not one of the people who are, you know, just reactionary and say, no tariffs. Tariffs are a tool. They're not the end all, the be all. They're a tool to get us to a policy that we need and must have in this country, and making sure that we hold on to good family sustaining wage jobs should be right at the very top of that. So how do we do this in a renegotiated NAFTA / Trump UMCA? How do we stop the ending of offshoring of jobs?
Yeah. So one of the first things we need to do with the USMCA renegotiation is to get rid of corporations' incentives to offshore jobs to Mexico. So number one, we need stronger labor standards, stronger labor enforcement mechanisms that really punish corporations for abusing labor rights in Mexico, or frankly, in the US or Canada for that matter. So, you know, the USMCA made some strides in this area relative to NAFTA. NAFTA never helped a single worker anywhere get their labor rights respected. The Biden administration actually used the USMCA to help, you know, roughly 40,000 workers gain access to independent labor unions for the first time. So that's a step in the right direction. But there are millions of workers who should be benefiting from labor rights enforcement provisions. You know, so we need to tighten them up. We need to make sure they're better funded. We also need new environmental enforcement mechanisms so that companies can't evade pollution controls in the U.S. by simply moving their production to Mexico. So that needs to be improved in a big way, too. And then finally, we need wage requirements to be straight up included in this pact. If you go to a town like Silao in central Mexico, you're going to find a General Motors plant that makes full-size pickup trucks, largely for sale in the U.S. market. It's as modern a plant as you will find anywhere in the United States. It's efficient. The workers are high skilled. The difference is they're being paid $3 per hour to start in that plant. You know, Mexico is somewhat less expensive to live in than the United States, but it's not that much cheaper. $3 an hour is still a poverty rate wage there. And, you know, that's not fair to the workers in that plant. And it's not fair to workers in the U.S. who have to compete with those wages. So what we say is let's end that unfair treatment. Let's create minimum wages for goods to qualify for free entry under NAFTA, premised on the concept of equal pay for equal work. We might not get there day one, but let's have a plan to get there. And let's get to work closing all the loopholes for companies to evade these new labor rights, these new wage requirements, and make sure that they actually play by the rules.
Yeah.
So there's other stuff that needs to be fixed too. We want to get rid of the ban on Buy American government purchasing preferences. We want to get rid of Trump's new giveaways to big tech that he added to the USMCA. You know, we want to get rid of the food safety ceilings and other provisions, but mainly we want to see a high wage, high standards agreement. And again, you know, if the Trump administration can't get there, it's ambitious. It actually is ambitious. But if they can't get there, then just do what you said. Get us out of this agreement altogether. We don't need it.
Yeah. Now, you talked about, you know, the food requirements. And, you know, one of the things that I had, you know, I've talked about for years is the country of origin labeling. I mean, the whole idea of choice as consumers is to have information. And if you don't know where things come from, I don't know that you can make an informed decision. And agricultural products are a part of that, no?
Yeah, no, it sounds insane, but the U.S. actually reversed its law requiring the country of origin to be labeled for meat products after challenges by Canada and Mexico under our trade deals. So, hey, we're renegotiating the trade deal now. Let's put in requirements that not only meat, but let's say dairy, let's say eggs, let's say, you know, poultry, let's say seafood, all have country of origin labeling on there so that consumers can make, you know, informed decisions. That's not against the free market. That's actually promoting freedom of choice.
It's part of the free market. That is a good thing. No, it's part of free trade. So that you're free choice. So you have the information to participate or the freedom to not participate and not purchase that product. It makes perfect. This should be a no-brainer. I do want to go back to something you said a moment about the wages. Because, you know, with Canada and the U.S., we're somewhere in the same world. And that was the case back in the 90s when we were arguing this the first time. I remember the argument about Mexico being included was that we were going to raise conditions there. And I remember the guy with the really big ears and the funny voice, you know, with the giant second sound. I remember him saying it was his view that what would happen is U.S. wages would have to come down if Mexican wages were to go up and that we would meet somewhere in the middle. And he was really wrong, because not only did our wages come down, he was right there, but theirs never really came up. And I think I want to go back to the labor part. I think that's a huge part of the independent labor union problem that goes on in Mexico.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, we've seen, you know, roughly 1 million jobs shipped from the United States to Mexico just under NAFTA, not under all these other free trade agreements where they're shipped to China and elsewhere around the world. And you would think over, you know, it's been 30 years now that wages for Mexican workers have gone up. They haven't. They remained flat almost that entire time. There was a slight, you know, increase under the AMLO administration, López Obrador, president of Mexico, when he increased minimum wages for the first time in forever there. But, you know, again, like $3 an hour to build a GM pickup truck. Our prices don't go down when we try to buy a car from General Motors because they're taking advantage of these low wages. So the workers there are getting screwed over, and workers here are forced to compete in really unfair ways. Even if your job isn't offshore, it puts a major, massive pressure downward on wages and benefits for virtually everyone, you know, trying to negotiate a better contract, trying to negotiate a better deal with their employer. And we're saying, all right, let's keep fighting for better labor standards and labor enforcement. We absolutely need to do that. But let's also just set some flat out wage requirements. let's have some safety valves in there where if we're seeing import surges, we just put a cap on it, you know, and just, you know, stop it. They're called quotas. And let's do things much, much more intelligently to ensure that working people are benefiting from these agreements and not just these greedy corporations.
So let me ask you this, because I think this is an issue that red hat, blue hat, green hat, no hat, politically, the voters, the working people of this country are kind of on the same page on. We want a lot of what you were talking about, but politically, it seems not so much. And I really don't know where Trump is. I don't think anyone does. I don't even think he knows where he is. Do you have much faith in Trade Representative Jamison Greer and his team? Much like, you know, I was not against Bob Lighthizer the last one, but I'm curious your thoughts on this group, and can we get somewhere that working people will agree on?
So Jamison Greer was actually the chief of staff for Bob Lighthizer, who was Trump's U.S. trade representative the first time he was in office. You know, we didn't see eye to eye with Lighthizer on everything, but he was certainly, you know, willing to meet us halfway on certain issues and, you know, a far throw better than trade representatives we had seen under, you know, Bush or Clinton or Obama. And so the fact that the Jamison Greer, Trump's new U.S. Trade Representative, comes out of that school of thinking is, I think, a positive thing. The thing that I don't know right now, and I don't think anyone really knows yet, is whether he has the gravitas and is going to have the ear of the president in the same way that Lighthizer did. Because Trump has this time, much more so than the first time around, really surrounded himself and packed his cabinet with these Wall Street billionaires. And yeah. If we have time for one example, I can tell you one of the executive orders that Trump passed that we really liked was taking a tentative step, but a first step towards closing a trade loophole that lets 4 million packages entering the U.S. every day to evade tariffs and to evade normal customs inspections. It's called the de minimis trade loophole. Trump took a step towards closing that loophole. It was great. We supported it. You know, a lot of different groups supported it. And then one of his billionaire advisors brought the president or the head of FedEx to the White House. FedEx is one of the companies that benefits the most from this trade loophole. In less than 24 hours, Trump rescinded that order, and the loophole is in place today. It creates just this massive way for companies to evade all these new tariffs supposedly being put into place, and it's also used by fentanyl smugglers to get fentanyl into the country.
But Arthur,
we step forward, and then his billionaire advisors get in there, and I don't know.
But hey, we get to buy really cheap stuff off of Temu and Shein.
You know, I'll tell you, I'm a large guy. You might be able to see if you're watching the web stream and not listening to the radio. I try to buy stuff made in the USA, union made wherever I can. I got a package for my birthday of socks. I don't know if it was Temu or Shein. I think it was from Amazon. These are just I don't want to swear.
Yeah, don't.
They were bad. Or twice, and they're going to fall off my feet, and I'm going to be back, you know, buying the U.S.
Yeah, and now your feet are probably going to turn green and all kinds of craziness. No, look.
You know, this fast fashion isn't good for anyone either.
No, I'm right there with you, and that's why this needs to be closed. And I think average everyday people, when you put it in those terms, they get it. So last line of question I've got for you, what do we do in this moment? Because I think this is a nonpartisan issue. I think this is an issue that can be organized around politically to get people to say, look, you're talking America first. You're talking, you know, all this made in America. Both sides have the same idea. Can we bring it together? What do we do here?
Yeah, so we need to take advantage of this USMCA review process. It's mandated. It's written right into the text of the agreement. All three countries need to start meeting this year to review the pact and suggest amendments to it. We need to make sure that all our elected officials are, you know, paying attention to this, promoting a positive vision for this, and that we don't just get, you know, the smoke and mirrors, superficial, and then we're back to business as usual. And so one way to do that, you know, check out our website, citizenstrade.org. Check out our partner organization, the Trade Justice Ed Fund's website, tradejusticeedfund.org. We're having webinars all the time. We've got petitions going. We've got, if you're a member of a union or another organization, organizational sign-on letters. And as things heat up this year, we just need everyone to be talking about this USMCA review and making sure it's on the political radar so that we can take advantage of it.
There you go, Arthur. I appreciate the time. Keep up the amazing work. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Arthur Stamoulos, Executive Director there of Citizens Trade. Make sure you check out their website, citizentrade.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Is this something that you think could bring us together? The idea of having a trade deal that works for working people and not the CEO class and certainly not Wall Street? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Some showers around this evening and a little breezy, mostly cloudy otherwise. There could be some snow mixed overnight. A low in the low 20s. Mostly sunny for tomorrow, cooler, but still nice for this time of year. High upper 30s. Warmer, though, for the rest of the week. Right now, it's 53.
Matt Nair on air.
Will Westmoreland is joining us now. He is a farmer in southwestern Missouri.
This is an 80-20 Republican area down here. You can't throw a rock without hitting a Republican. And I still know all the guys I graduated with. So I always ask, don't admit you were wrong. Just admit you were lied to. That's a lot easier to do. If you just admit you were lied to, you can get over here with us and start working to fight the problem.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So all of the economic upheaval, you've got people wondering, what's the plan? And I don't think there is a plan. I keep coming back to my problem with Donald Trump is I don't think there is really a plan. I think there are a lot of people who have thrown ideas at him, and he's grasping at ideas and causing chaos, I think for chaos sake. And also, it really is about payback. It is about retribution. You can't come up with any other reason. So the question I got to ask, and again, I'm going to turn this around for my red hats, who during the Biden years were going, my 401k was better under Donald Trump. My 401k was better under Joe Biden. Here to share some thoughts on where we are, where we're going, and what we're doing. I've asked my good friend Sarah Burris to come share some thoughts. She's a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, where you can find her work. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how the heck are you?
So how's that 401k working out for you? All my red hats were saying, Rick, it was better under Trump. It's not better today.
I lost $1,000 last week.
Wow.
Because I looked at it on Monday because I started getting nervous, once you start hearing some of the things that they're talking about and the Fed considering, the interest rate question. I was just like, okay, I'm going to check it and then start figuring out. Cause I have one of those regular, throw it into all of the safe, whatever thing yep. selection. And
like a lot of Americans.
Yeah. And so when I looked at it on Friday, I'd lost $1,000. And I was just like, oh crap, this is a thing.
The good thing is you're nowhere near retirement age. If they allow a retirement age going forward, so you'll have time to make it up. And look, you're going to work till you die anyway, so you didn't need that money anyhow.
I know, right? I'm just going to have to build myself a really nice designer cardboard box.
No, and the reality is this economic uncertainty is causing a lot of interesting players. The CEO class, not thrilled. In fact, we're seeing reports coming out that companies are warning their employees of potential layoffs. Telling the boards and the investors, hey, you know, these federal cuts, they might hurt, considering a lot of government spending props up a lot of industry. This could trickle down.
Oh, and then some. That's the thing, is I think folks look at the federal government in terms of who's actually working for the feds right now. The thing is we've privatized so much, particularly whenever it comes to the military industrial complex, that we're subsidizing huge industries, whether it's, you know, we know about oil and gas, but obviously the people like Raytheon and Boeing and all of those guys. So if we're freezing contracts or if we're canceling contracts for whatever, you know, branch of government, whether it's FAA or Pentagon or whoever, that means that those companies are going to have to start making cuts. And I mean, the fact that these CEOs thought that they could control Donald Trump just blows my mind. And they gave so much money to him, not just like for campaign, they gave millions to his transition, thinking that they could control him. And I'm just like, how's that working out for you guys?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It's not the CEOs that I care about. It's all those working people who are going to lose those jobs. And interestingly enough, it's a lot of union people who voted for Trump. And look, I remember during the campaign having my union brothers and sisters wearing the red hats, telling me how great it was going to be, how he was going to be this great job creator. Day one, eggs were going to be cheap. Gas was going to be free. It was going to be a working class utopia.
Yeah, I think it's really funny, particularly with the eggs thing, that I was joking that we can buy weed in a store, and now we're basically trying to, like, you know, get eggs on the streets. Just like, hey man, how many eggs you got in your stash right now?
And the best answer that the person in charge of this in the Trump administration was to go get chickens.
Yeah, which is funny because I was making that as a joke for weeks. I've been joking about that, and now they're talking about it as if it's serious. And oh man, that's terrifying. Like, what's next? Are we gonna have to, like, get a cow? Like, do we have to go milk Elsie every day for our cereal?
Yeah, no, ultimately this is the world that they believe in. You're on your own is what they're telling you. We don't believe in doing anything. You're on your own. We're not going to help you. And the sad reality is I don't think we've heard it yet as an entire nation, but I kind of hope we will. And I keep saying the suffering, when we start suffering about a bit more, maybe that's when we wake up.
Maybe. I would hope so. I think I started thinking about victory gardens, you know, and it's like, what are we going to call them? Like recession gardens?
Liberty gardens.
Right? Like we're freedom. We're totally screwed gardens. Freedom gardens. Yeah. And now they're talking a little bit about the idea of a potential recession. And so, you know, you're starting to hear some of the Trump economist people being like, well, you know, it's going to be difficult for a little while, but then things are going to be great, right? Like we're going to keep following into this world of, don't worry, any minute, everything's going to be great again. Don't worry, everything's going to be great again. And instead it's like, oh no, a recession is patriotic now. Like, there's nothing more American than a recession.
And again, for who's it for? I understand.
Yeah.
During a recession, who loses their homes?
Yeah.
Working people.
It's us.
And then who gets to buy them up for pennies on the dollar? In fact, you know, Donald Trump, you know, last presidency was very keen on the idea. You know, we need that. We need to get people, and we get cheap inventory. It's a massive redistribution of wealth scheme, to where working people who are just trying to struggle to get ahead, every time one of these recessions comes around, they get wiped out, and the wealthy who can weather these storms, they just get wealthier by sucking up all the assets of working people and go, oh, sorry, you lost.
And then you end up with people who are going into towns, buying up houses so that they can then rent them investment properties. And then they can raise the rent over time and just completely decimate a town so that, you know, they can get their own profits.
It's all about the profit. And look, if anyone thinks that these people are in government to have more efficient government, to do things better for we the people, give me a break. For instance, and I've been waiting to hear this story. I know your mother last Friday, I guess, Friday, right? Tried to attempt to sign up for Social Security. Good for her for getting there. How'd that go?
So at the end of the year, she called Social Security to say, you know, in May, she's going to start pulling her Social Security. And they were like, okay, well, we can schedule an appointment 3 months from now, which, you know, surprise.
3 months.
Yeah, 3 months in March. And so she had this appointment and was ready to go. They called her to like an automated reminder call she got. And so she was just like, yeah, no, it's going to happen. I got a reminder call. And I was just like, I hope so. She was like, well, obviously if they're sending out reminder calls, then obviously somebody's got to be working there. And I was like, was it automated? And she goes, well, yeah, but somebody's got to be working that. And it's like, or nobody is there to turn that stuff off. And sure enough, nobody calls. And she gets on the phone and 3 hours later, nobody had answered. And, you know, it's, she hung up, she gave up. And I was like, she asked me, we were texting back and forth and she said, so what time should I hang up? And I said, when the office closes. And she was like, oh, I can't sit here that long. I was like, that's what they count on.
Yeah.
That's what they want. This is part of, if you can't get on Social Security, then you won't get the Social Security. Like, this isn't about like, oh, I'm never going to touch it. It doesn't matter if nobody works there. Like, that's the thing that's so crazy is that, I mean, anybody who's going to end up having to, any like younger baby boomers who are going to have to sign up in the next 10 years, I mean, you better hope that some Democrat comes in and hires up a bunch of people to be able to staff it again.
Yep.
Like, I just keep thinking about, like, what's going to happen in 4 years? Are we going to have some big reconstruction? Are we going to have, like...
Yes.
Or is he just going to cancel, you know, the elections and the government entirely?
No, this is what I keep saying, Sarah. I mean, your mother is not alone in this. There are thousands, tens of thousands, you know, probably a million people trying to do the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And this is not bad government. This is bad governance. This is the guy at the top who has made a conscious choice to fire all these people who are there to serve the public, and they're not there. And if you're not getting your Social Security, I don't care if you're a red hat, blue hat, or green hat, it doesn't matter. You're not getting your Social Security that you paid into, that you earned, and that you should get on purpose. This is a policy choice. And for me, the organizing that can come around this is pretty important.
Yeah, and we talk every week about how annoyed we are with the Democrats. And over, I'm like, what are you guys doing?
Nothing.
And the answer is nothing.
No, I've told you this before. You know, in a street fight, Democrats will hold your coat. Looking to them to be the great fighter in this, looking to them to stand up to the bully, I don't know if they're up to it yet. That's why we have to be the ones. Democrats are tools. Politicians are tools. We need people on the streets. We need people at their offices. We need to be pushing, organizing, and pushing. Doesn't matter who you voted for in the last election. Right now, what we need to be doing is holding on to our Social Security, holding on to the EPA, holding on to clean water and clean air and safe schools. We need to be holding on to this stuff in a way that makes Democrats, you know, find their spine a little bit.
I mean, you're being charitable with the idea that they'll hold your coat. I don't think they're even showing up. That's the problem. I mean, I'd be happy if they would even show up and offer to hold the coat at this point. But... Nope. They're not even doing that.
That was interesting. I saw last week, even on The View, they're fighting on The View because they don't know what to do. And usually they're full of good ideas. but look, you know, the response to Trump's speech is an example of no leadership and scattered ideas. The fact that Representative Green was the only one to speak out and put himself in the position to be the only one to speak out is, to me, a failure on every level of organizing and on every level of politics.
And I think we were talking maybe last week about you know, what they could do, what the options were, and this whole idea of like holding up signs or holding up a deal of eggs was ridiculous. I had thought that they absolutely should walk out. Like, there should be a big moment where everybody stands up at once and walks out. And
they had that opportunity, Sarah. That the moment they marched Representative Green out of there, every one of them should have walked behind him.
Yeah. And so I think what happened on Tuesday was just, and what has followed, the fact that Democrats, that there are some Democrats were like, oh no, that was inappropriate. That's been inappropriate. And they're really treating it like we still are operating under this world where norms are still in place.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, have you guys not been paying attention?
No.
Are you really that far removed from what is happening that you're either in denial or just completely clueless? Because those norms do not exist anymore. This is not normal.
Yeah, they're fighting like it's 1999.
And if they keep behaving like this, it's just like, then what's the point of you? Why are you there?
I get these emails, and I'm sure you get them too, you know, from different organizations. We filed a lawsuit and we won. And look, mm-hmm. Democrats and left-leaning organizations are filing hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits, and they're winning across the board, all of them. Nobody cares because the media is still, you know, Trump's going to do whatever he wants. And we've talked about this before. I don't think he cares what the court says. Ultimately, he knows he's got the Supreme Court. But what are they going to do? Are they really going to send in, you know, the military to come make him do something? No.
Well, they'd send in the U.S. Marshals. Those are the guys who basically, and that is my question. I think some of the lower courts have been willing to entertain the idea of holding somebody in contempt. And it's like, if they do that, if somebody is held in contempt, you better get the marshals ready to go and get them. Because if you're just sort of throwing out this idea of, oh, we're going to hold you in contempt on paper, then it's a waste of time. And I mean, everybody keeps talking about like what happens whenever this clash happens, where the courts say one thing and Trump says, okay, now enforce it. I think we're already there. I think we're already in the constitutional crisis because, you know, we've already had the courts, you know, the Supreme Court basically step in and say, you know, we're throwing this back to the lower court that basically said you can't freeze the USAID funding. So, and what has been interesting to watch since then is how angry MAGA has gotten at Amy Coney Barrett, of all people,
oh,
because
yeah.
She sided with the liberals on the case. And I'm just like, man, she's gonna get just trounced with threats. And it's just like, that's who these people are. That's the kind of world that they want to live in, is you know, you do what I say or I threaten to kill you and your family. Like, that is the world that these courts are living in, whether they're, you know, the MAGA appointees or, you know, liberals who are willing to stand up for the rule of law.
So let me ask you this, because I don't think either one of us have an awful lot of faith in the Democrats at this moment. Is it going to be the Republicans who save us? I mean, I saw Paul Ryan speaking the other day about Trump. I'm going, where'd you dig him up? You know, I saw Michael Steele, you know, coming out saying, a former RNC chair, you know, saying, you know, what, Trump's a petty, afraid little man.
Yeah, he's a scared little boy sitting behind a really big desk. And that's a perfect way to describe him. I mean, I think maybe it is that you have to have Republicans fight back against Republicans. Because I'm thinking back to like the kind of stuff that the Lincoln Project was doing in 2020 and in 2024. And it was bottom dwelling, petty, you know, willing to get in the gutter. And I don't know that Democrats have that.
Right. Where Democrats just don't have it in them. In fact, you know, I saw a story of Tim Walz, the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats, saying that maybe we played too safe. No.
You're just like, please, for the love of God. Really? Really?
Yeah, like, maybe.
I don't know if that's like Midwest nice for FU, but it's so, again, like, this is really far removed from the world that we're living in. And we have to get Democrats to wake up, to realize that, you know, this, the norms are gone. You need to operate differently. Yep. You need to shift how things are working. And well, until then, you're going to keep getting, you know, slapped down over and over again.
I did see a story. Democrats are starting to curse now. So, you know, the beginning, it's the beginning of finding a spine. A little bit. A little bit.
I mean, I heard Jake Tapper say a-holes the other day. I was like, oh.
There might be hope. Yeah, hold your breath. Going to be an interesting week ahead. Lots of fun. What are you paying attention to? What's on the horizon for us?
Well, this is a really important time right now for people to start planning your recession gardens. So, I mean, hands to God, if you're going to start planting vegetables in the next month or so.
There you go.
That may be the route you got to go.
That is the best advice I've gotten all day. Sarah, good stuff as always. Keep up the great work there at Raw Story. Appreciate the time.
Thank you. Everybody hang in there.
Hang in there is right. Make sure you check out Sarah's work at rawstory.com. Sarah Burris, our reporter friend. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day that farm labor activist Cesar Chavez broke a 25-day fast. He fasted as a sign of commitment to nonviolence during the struggle for farm workers in Delano, California, to gain fair wages and safe working conditions. During the fast, he only drank water. He broke the fast with a ceremonial mass in Delano. Presidential candidate Robert Kennedy was in attendance. At the mass, Chavez was too weak to give a speech, so he gave his written words to Reverend James Drake to share with those in attendance. He wrote, "We are gathered here today not so much to observe the end of the fast, but because we are a family bound together in common struggle for justice. We are a union family celebrating our unity and the nonviolent nature of our movement. The fast has had different meanings for different people. Some of you may still wonder about its meaning and importance. It was not intended as a pressure against any growers. For that reason, we have suspended negotiations and arbitration proceedings and relaxed the militant picketing and boycotting of the strike during this period. I undertook the fast because my heart was filled with grief and pain for the suffering of the farm workers. The fast was first for me and then for all of us in this union. It was a fast for nonviolence and a call for sacrifice." Chavez engaged in two more long fasts during his life as an activist. He fasted in 1972 for 24 days. And in 1988, at the age of 61, he fasted for 36 days to highlight the harmful effects of pesticides on farm workers and their children. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, you know, we're going to find out where Trump goes. You know, as we've been talking about with Sarah, you know, look, the courts are overwhelmingly, almost universally against Trump's antics. In fact, on Thursday last week, a federal judge ruled that Trump firing Gwen Wilcox from the National Labor Relations Board was illegal. Couldn't do it. She wrote, "An American president is not a king, not even an elected one. And his powers to remove federal officers and honest civil servants like plaintiff is not absolute." Now, understand, he's been losing a lot of these because he wanted to wipe out all of the independent watchdog agencies, all of the independent labor folks, because he wants dictatorial control. Now, the question is, you know, will he listen? The answer is no. And understand, there's going to be a lot of stuff going on that we're going to have to clean up. But understand, we're going to get through this. Together, we're going to get through all of this mess. And the reality is, we got to face the suffering head on. We can't run away from it, can't hide. We have to run through it. And on the other side, we move on the solutions. And we do it aggressively. And this is where, look, I'm not beating up on Democrats because I like to. I want to encourage them to be a little more militant, a little stronger of the spine, a little Bastille of the spine, a little aggressive. And organize in a way that we're going to move forward. And we have to stop wasting our time. We've got to stop arguing with and explaining things to people who have already decided they're not into this. They're not going to understand. They're never going to understand. And they don't want to understand. They don't want to be in the real world. They want their fantasy. So save your time, save your energy, save your breath, save your sanity. And you've heard me say this 1,000 times. Don't feed the trolls. Don't argue with the fives, and above all, don't read the comments on social media. Why do people feel the need to argue with Johnny964535 on social media? Why? When we've got so much to do. You know, I get this all the time. People ask, you know, why don't you have people on the show who disagree with you, Rick? Because look, I'm an organizer. I want to reach people who want to be reached, people who want to fight for a better future, people who are looking for answers, looking for opportunities to bring us together and make better lives. Look, shouting talking points at each other, that doesn't do me any good, doesn't do anyone any good. What we need to be doing is we need to find those things that we agree on. Those moments like Sarah Burris's mother, spending an entire day waiting for a phone call that everyone knew was not coming because they've gutted our government. This stuff is going to continue to happen to people. And as it does, and as they don't get their Social Security, as they don't get Medicare, as people get affected by the massive cuts to Medicaid, as Trump supporters lose jobs that they didn't think it was going to be them, there's an opportunity to bring people together. But not until then. There's a large portion of our population, they're not ready yet. They're not in a space where they're willing to listen. So why yell at them? Because they're only going to yell back. And you're only going to shut down any opportunity to bring people together. What we focus on people who want to move forward. We focus on people who want a better future. We focus on people who want better opportunities for themselves, their children, their families. And we can do that. We can do it. I've got great faith. But as long as we're playing their game, which is, let's see how horrible we can be to each other. Let's see how cruel we can be. Let's see how I can gotcha. As long as we're playing that game, we're losing. Because we're not good at it. We're not as good as they are. They've got decades of experience. And as long as we're fighting on their terms, we will lose. It's time to start fighting on ours. And ours are, how do we make sure that we have an economy, a system that works for everyone? We're still nibbling around the edges. There are opportunities, real opportunities. For someone with a real idea and real policy to make lives better. We've gotten into this mess through bad policy. We've gotten into this mess from people who don't believe in government running it. We've gotten into this mess by going, it's the smart people, the elites who we want. We want the really, really smart people. You know, the people who are smart enough to organize a government in a way that benefits a handful over the rest of us. And then somehow we've bought into what the charlatans sell us. So as I started this, you know, my grandfather said, you know, you never trust a cheat, a liar, or a thief. And yet somehow we've figured out how to not just trust one of them, but all three and in the same people. It's time, some old school values. It's time to look each other in the eye and have serious conversations. And it's time to stop with the social media. Give yourself a break. Stop reading the comments. Because social media only allows people to be the worst versions of themselves. Be better. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcast. You'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Wall Street's nosedives are just temporary, say some Republican lawmakers to ABC News. Analysts blame the uncertainty over a tariff war between the U.S. and trade partners Mexico and Canada. A federal judge orders the Trump administration to pay nearly $2 billion in foreign aid, but stops short of blocking a review of foreign aid payments. Tomorrow's vote in the House to avert a government shutdown at the end of the week could come down to a one-vote margin. House Speaker Mike Johnson.
No one wants to shut the government down, and we are governing doing the responsible thing as Republicans.
House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
The House Republican so-called spending bill does nothing to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Quite the opposite.
If it passes, it goes to the Senate. Explosions from the crash of a cargo ship into a U.S. fuel tanker off eastern England. Fog was reported. This is ABC News. Gaza ceasefire.